sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear a speech given by author Russ Baker at the Treason in America conference in March of 2010 in Pennsylvania. I'm halfway through his book called Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. It's an amazingly well-researched, well-documented, and well-written book. And on page after page, I'm continually astounded by the information he presents. Every American should read this book. Here's what it says on the back of the book. Was the rise of the disastrous George W. Bush just a matter of family connections and sly, cynical operatives such as Karl Rove? Or was something more at work, something that endures beyond Bush's departure from Washington? Award-winning investigative journalist Russ Baker provides the astonishing answers in Family of Secrets, a groundbreaking inquiry into the Bush dynasty and the shadowy elite that has quietly steered the American Republic for the past half century and more. Baker shows how this network of figures in intelligence, the military, oil, and finance enabled, and in turn benefited handsomely from, the Bush's perch at the highest levels of government. This deeply entrenched elite remains in power regardless of who sits in the Oval Office. Family of Secrets punctures the conventional wisdom on both Presidents Bush. It exposes the hidden truth behind W's purported religious conversion and the debacle of Hurricane Katrina, and reveals his secret motive for invading Iraq. It probes the murky history of Poppy Bush and his lifelong service to the intelligence apparatus. Ultimately, Family of Secrets is about much more than just the Bushes. It changes the way we comprehend post-war history, from the JFK assassination to Watergate, and compels us to take a new look at events now unfolding. And now here's a little bit about Russ Baker. He's an award-winning investigative journalist who has written for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The New York Times, The Nation, The Los Angeles Times, The Washington Post, The Village Voice, and Esquire, and has served as a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. He is the founder of the website whowhatwhy.com, a nonpartisan, nonprofit news website. And now here's the first part of Russ Baker's speech at the March 2010 Treason in America conference, talking about his book, Family of Secrets, which came out in 2009.
I was on the train the other day going to Boston, and they make this announcement, and they say, if you see something, say something. And I thought, well, that's sort of ironic, because all the people I know of who saw something and said something got in trouble. And I think we're going to hear from maybe one or two people who worked for the FBI. There are people who worked for the Secret Service. There are people who worked for all of these agencies who spoke up, and all kinds of things happened to them. Some of them ended up in a psych ward, others face various forms of retribution. Certainly, contempt and ridicule are very, very common when you're not with the conventional script, shall we say. And it's amazing to me to see how you can be marginalized for caring. And I've seen that my whole journalistic career, that people who actually took a risk because they believed in the espoused principles of this country, and then bad things happened to them. And of course, you know, as we're growing up, we're going to school, we're told about the values of this country and how it's so important to do the right thing, and then there's no follow-through on that. I know many of you are here because of the 9/11 issue. I am going to be speaking about that only somewhat tangentially, but I should tell you what I will be talking about is very much directly related. And I should also tell you that I do know something about 9/11 because I was there. I live in New York City in Lower Manhattan, and I heard the planes go over my apartment. I was surprised to hear planes that loud, and I turned the television on and saw the footage of the planes hitting the building. I raced downtown, and I was reporting that day for the Los Angeles Times. The rest of the week, I wrote a number of different stories for The Telegraph, a major newspaper in the UK, The London Observer, The Frankfurter Allgemeine, and various other international publications. And I also happened to be standing there in front of a building called World Trade Center 7, speaking on the phone to my editor at the Los Angeles Times, right when the building collapsed in front of me. And I remember my shock. And I remember, I actually described this to the editor as the building was falling. And I remember just saying, oh my God, this building is pancaking neatly right in front of me. And he exclaimed, and he said, well, how can that be? That's just incredible. I said, I don't know. Anyway, so I was there. I don't have any inside information. It's a subject I'm going to talk about, and I am very, very interested in it, but I just wanted to get that out initially. One of the things that we see that happened with this issue, and I'm speaking not of particular theories or anything, I'm just talking about the whole issue itself of what happened, one of the biggest cataclysms in American and recent world history, was that the media turned away from this. And part of this was revulsion and shock and to the system. To the individual system, and then to the body politic. This was so disturbing on every possible level that it doesn't compute. And what happens with this kind of trauma is we just shut down. And you all know this. You all are here because you didn't shut down, but you all know people, probably in your immediate family, your neighbors and so on, who just shut down. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want to talk about it. It is overwhelming to the senses, and it's the same thing for the media. It's not that the media is in cahoots or is bad or something like that. It's just that the media is just a whole lot of people trying to cope, trying to do their jobs, trying to keep their jobs, trying to stay focused and so on. And it was sort of, you've heard the expression too big to fail about, you know, Goldman Sachs and all these places. Well, this story was like too big to cover. And what bothers me about that as a journalist is that no serious journalist should ever out of hand, well, number one, they should never fail to cover. They should always cover at least the big stories. And somebody was telling me that, I think it was at the Washington Post, you remember this couple who got into that White House dinner? And apparently they had put together a team of 30 people to cover that. And this reporter pointed out to me, they said, we never had more than, you know, three people covering Iraq. It gives you a sense of the priorities. And so the big stories, our obligation is we must cover the big stories. And no serious journalist should ever, out of hand, reject any scenario as completely impossible or implausible where human nature and power are concerned. It is our job to consider the evidence and to dig in. And one of the problems, and I'm sure you know this if you've approached journalists, and I have to say I'm probably guilty of the same thing, so many people come to us with so many things, and frankly, some of them are a little bit off. And a lot of these stories are wrong if you check them out, and so you can't check everything out, so there's this kind of resistance. But there shouldn't be resistance to a story which happened. Everybody knows it happened. Everybody knows it was huge. Everybody knows this enormous number of people died. All these basic facts about it that are not in dispute. Forget about all the other things that you're discussing that there's some contention on, but just think of all the things that are not in dispute. There are so many of them that if you just look at the reporting on the things that are not in dispute, it's inadequate. It is inadequate. As I say, I'm not an expert on this. I spent the last 5 years working on Family of Secrets, and that took all of my energy. But I can see that I, as a moderately informed person on this issue, I don't understand exactly how they know who was on the planes and were they really definitely on the planes and did we really get a good sort of scientific evaluation of exactly how those buildings came down, if in fact they came down the way they say that they did. So these are all very, very interesting to me. You don't have to have a position on 9/11 to want answers. And you don't have to be a kook to wonder if the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission, a commission that itself has no credibility, have basically claimed that they were lied to, that there might be something going on. And if you look back at the other commissions over the years, I can't even name them all, because the first thing you do when anything happens and you don't want to deal with it is you create a commission. So there have been commissions for everything, right? Iraq, Iran-Contra, Watergate, and so on. And if we have time to go through a few of the revelations in Family of Secrets, one of them is that somebody earlier said we need more Woodwards and Bernsteins, but as I reveal in Family of Secrets, Woodward and Bernstein were not who you thought they were, and the whole Watergate story was not what we thought it was. So any commission, by definition, and any major investigation that wins the plaudits of the establishment, you got to step back for a second and say, how good was this thing? How many of you heard of Operation Northwoods? Okay, you are not a typical crowd. I see most of the hands going up. I did that at another event and zero hands went up. Since you know what it was, I mean, we know from testimony and documents of people on the inside in the government that the use of provocative false flag operations to justify some kind of operation that was considered to be necessary has existed. We know Operation Northwoods, this was under John F. Kennedy, where the Joint Chiefs, they wanted an excuse to go into Cuba, and so they wanted basically to stage an attack on the United States, supposedly by Cuba, and they even acknowledged it might be necessary to sustain some fatalities in the United States. That is not disputed, that this was the mindset of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And that's all you need to at least be open to the possibility that there is such thinking or there has been such thinking. It's monstrous to us because we don't think that way, but other people may think differently. There's a crisis of confidence in America today, and we see this on all levels, and this kind of feeds into the rise of the Glenn Becks and what have you and the kind of hysteria. And this is because we're sort of panicked that we can't trust anything. The media in the lowest esteem it's been in, the government, certainly the financial system, and on and on and on. And because of this, there is not only a crisis, but a tremendous opportunity. There's a tremendous opportunity for journalists to show what we can do and to regain, to win the public's trust. Unfortunately, there is tremendous pressure on journalists not to pursue certain stories. And I'm not talking about necessarily an organized effort. If it was an organized effort, it would be maybe something that we could do something about or at least identify. It's much more insidious than that. And I don't remember the exact phrasing I use in Family of Secrets. If you read it, you may know, where I talk about this kind of quiet thing that I covered totalitarian and authoritarian societies, the fall of communism and so forth. And one of the things you see is that most people help preserve the system, not because they were told to do it, but simply because they were afraid. And there was this sort of self-censorship. And this exists throughout all societies, and it exists, to my mind, in the most insidious form in a society like ours where we bray about how free we are. That is where you see most of that. Because if you're proud of yourself and how green your lawn is and how well you generally do investing and how cool NASCAR is and everything else, and you're telling your kids and you take them for 5 minutes to Valley Forge and then it's on to the consumerism plunge at the outlet mall, you really don't want to hear that everything ain't hunky-dory. And so there is this kind of pressure on ourselves to not talk about things that matter, and then on other people, shut up. We don't want to talk about that. An earlier speaker urged you, I thought he was very eloquent, I think it was Manny Badillo, and he said, read. And, you know, I love that because people, I do a lot of, you know, radio shows and things, and people always say to me, well, this is so depressing. What can we do? And what can we do about it? We're just, you know, one person or something. And I say, well, first of all, almost everything meaningful that happened in history was one person. Almost every cure, almost every scientific advancement, Amazon and Microsoft and rockets and everything else, I mean, it basically started with one person. So every single person in this room actually holds a tremendous amount of power. You just have to be determined and figure out how to implement that. But reading is an amazing thing because here's a way that you can kind of build personal power in the comfort and privacy of your own home. And I hope to get a little bit more into that. One thing I notice is that most people simply do not have the command of the most elementary facts about our country. And if you talk to them, they get almost everything wrong. To say nothing of the fact that polls show that 40-some percent of the public can't name the vice president and things like that. But, I mean, if you take the people who consider themselves better informed, they have the wrong narrative, it turns out, on almost everything. They misunderstand people who were president of the United States, maybe Reagan, let's say, for 8 years, they don't really understand what was going on or who he was. They have wrong impressions of so many different things. And I attribute this largely to the fact that they're not reading enough, or they're all, if you look at the Amazon ratings, they're all rushing out to buy Sarah Palin's memoirs or something like that. But they're not reading more challenging material, which is out there. And there are tons of great books. They come out all the time. And I've always got huge stacks around my house, and I'm in the middle of reading four or five of them because there's so much amazing work being done. And we all owe it to ourselves and to our society to be constantly reading and bugging everybody else to read. Okay, so speaking of reading, I just out of curiosity, how many of you happen to have heard of Family of Secrets? Probably half? Okay. How many of you have it or have read it? Okay, it's like 20% or something. This is a book about a man who was just president of the United States, the most powerful person in the world, for 8 incredibly convulsive years. It is a book that has a shocker on every single page. New information that has never been reported before, information that I didn't know until I found it in the course of doing this research. It's so shocking, I am told, that it changes your understanding of major American events, not just during the 8 years he was president, but going back decades. And for example, if you look on the back cover, I don't remember the exact quote, it's from a man named Dan Rather, who was earning, I think, you know, $8 million a year and on top of the world, and then suddenly he was persona non grata over an issue where he was challenging or reporting on something relating to the Bush family. Dan gave me a very nice blurb for the book where he says, this changed my understanding of even events to which I was an eyewitness. And so we have, for those of you who've read it, know of 4 or 5 chapters of all new material relating to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Sounds strange for that to be in a book about the Bushes, and I'll try to explain a little bit more about that if we have time. And about Watergate, a few chapters on that, and about Richard Nixon, things that I didn't know and that we didn't know. And Dan had covered these things. You may know he was in Dealey Plaza, and you may know that he was the only reporter who was allowed, as I understand it, to see the famed Zapruder film of Kennedy with the famed head snap. And supposedly, I mean, that he what he reported was that the head went forward, and we later found it went back. How and why he interpreted it that way, something else. But the fact of the matter is that he believes that Family Secrets has new information, and it's interesting how figures of that power, when they're not anymore ensconced in the establishment, their eyes are opened and they become much more receptive to this. And I actually have heard from a former Secretary of Defense of the United States who said that Family Secrets blew him away, and he said, wow, you're really connecting the dots. And that's interesting to me that somebody at that level would feel that this was something, he didn't know these things. So the premise of Family of Secrets is that there's a completely different history out there, even about the subjects and the people we think we already know everything about. And one of the things we discovered when Family of Secrets came out was that we couldn't get people to read it. And do you know why? There was one refrain, and I'm sure you can guess what it all was. I'm sick of Bush, and I don't want to hear another word about him. I'm moving on, right? Well, how many countries, Pinochet and Hitler and Mussolini or whatever, could people have said, and I'm not making an explicit comparison, but I'm saying where somebody fell out of favor for good reason, there was a rush to the exits. And of course, that's not what you should do. When you discover that something goes terribly wrong with your family or your house, you don't say, I don't want to hear another word about it. You say, I better deal with this and see if the house itself is rotted at its foundations. I better figure this out before the whole bloody thing collapses. So this is what we thought should have happened, but understandably, people didn't know there was anything new in there. They thought, well, it's the same old thing. How many of you have heard of a book by a guy named Scott McClellan? It's about the same, but if you ask a general audience, it's you know, much higher percentage. Now, he was Bush's communications director, press secretary, and so on. His book came out. He got on every major show. He was on everything. He was on Jon Stewart. He was on from the left to the right and so on. Now, maybe not the right, but he was on everything. And his book had, as I recall, almost no revelations in there. There was like one thing that Bush might have, he might have overheard Bush saying he couldn't remember whether he had smoked marijuana. You remember? That was like a couple of things. When you have a story about a big subject and you have almost nothing new, but a couple of little things they can tease, you're on all the shows. But if you go out there and you say, hey, folks, we missed everything, they go, gotta go, no time for you. And that's what happened with this book. Originally, I was told by the publisher that they had gotten word. The Today Show was very interested in having me on, and NPR, some of you may listen to that, Morning Edition, wanted an exclusive, and on and on and on. And the New York Times wanted an advance review copy, specially requested under embargo and so forth. And total silence. Total silence. Total silence. And then when the reviews came out, there was one in the Los Angeles Times, a paper to which I've contributed, where the man basically began with a quote from Richard Hofstadter about the paranoid mind. And I believe he misrepresented Hofstadter anyway, and whatever you think or care about Hofstadter is another matter. But this was supposed to tell people. And he actually says in the review, whatever you do, do not read this book. And I actually saw online things where people said, you know, after reading that review, I think I won't read this book. And I would think if some guy you didn't know said, do not read this book, you, like a child, would do the exact opposite, right? Where's the cookie jar, you know? So this was amazing to me. And he actually said that I obviously was a nut because anybody who did not believe that Lee Harvey Oswald had acted alone did not deserve a place at the table of civilized discourse. Well, I thought, well, that's interesting because like 80% of Americans don't believe that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. And the House Select Committee on Assassinations, I mean, we know the House of Representatives is not really edgy. They concluded a probable conspiracy, though they couldn't figure out who was behind it. So this is what has happened. This is the challenge. And this is one of the reasons that we're getting the word out in a kind of a guerrilla manner through the grassroots. Family of Secrets began when I started wondering in 2004 about what had happened to America. I won't go into this whole story, but I was living abroad. I was training investigative journalists in the former Yugoslavia. The run-up to the invasion of Iraq began. I could see, to my own satisfaction, that they were rushing this, that they had predetermined they wanted to do this, and that they were putting up evidence that supported something rather than having fairly considered whether this was the right course or was even necessary. And so as I lived in Europe, I noticed this sea change where people were having increasing animosity toward Americans, all Americans, and toward me. And if you travel around the world generally, people love Americans because they've heard all those great things about this is the best country in the world, et cetera, et cetera. And so here was this tremendous animosity. And I thought, well, what had changed so much? And so I went back to the United States in early 2004, and I thought, how do people get in power? How did this guy, George W. Bush, let's face it, anybody in this room was probably better qualified to be president than he was. And this is just from his own friends. And when I started working on this book and I would travel to people, they would all kind of chuckle. They thought this was the biggest joke imaginable. That their buddy and the ne'er-do-well, this and that, and there he, boy, wasn't that something. But, you know, they were used to that because they'd all gotten into the best schools through legacies and things like that, and they'd all gotten jobs through their wives or girlfriend's father, and they'd gotten tips, inside tips, to trade stocks and make money, and everything came to them pretty easily, so this seemed like the normal course of democracy. And so I thought, well, gee, you know, I just wonder if there's anything more to this story of this country and where we've gotten to. And by the way, there was this thing called 9/11, which kind of came and went, and it was this amazing, huge story, but there was no explanation for this thing, not a proper one. And then there was the invasion of Iraq, and there was no proper explanation for that because the reasons they gave clearly turned out to be false. So I thought, well, boy, I mean, everything turns out to be false. I mean, what's going on here? Who are these people? Are we in the Truman Show? Remember that movie where the guy discovers his whole life is a movie and everybody around him are hired actors and he's being manipulated for the show? You start wondering, what is the reality here? And so I thought, you know, I'm just going to poke around in the bushes and see if there's anything with all those books that have been written that could possibly have been missed. And do you know what? You can take any subject, no matter how well covered it is, and you find out they didn't even begin to scratch the surface. So how and why did Bush become president and do what he did? Well, what did he do? The moment he was in office, he began doing all these strange things. This is before 9/11. He began doing things that are typical of a police state. And I wrote pieces for The Nation magazine and other places, Slate and so forth, about all these curious things and lockdowns of records and prior presidential records and trying to prevent the Freedom of Information Act from operating properly. These were all the kind of things you would expect, again, from a Pinochet, not from the President of the United States. So I thought, well, this is weird. These are sort of police state tendencies. And then there were these corporatist influences where they suddenly had this idea that the job of the EPA was to hire everybody from every chemical company in America and cancel all the laws. And again, I mean, if any of you have read, for example, Naomi Klein's excellent Shock Doctrine, where she talks about that this is deliberate. This is a philosophy that is actually acknowledged that the only way they can get what they want to create shocks, tremendous shocks to the system that are so traumatizing and convulsive that anything can be instituted right after that. And of course, you know what happened after 9/11. Constant those alerts. Remember those alerts? And they always came right before an election, and they were never about anything. People in the FBI complained and said, these are not even legitimate. We don't want to put these things out. I remember living in New York City. I don't know if they do it anymore. You suddenly would see a ton of police cars just, vroom, you know, going in a convoy. Have you heard about that? It turns out that is an exercise to shock. They want people to pay attention. And so they practice these things. And it's not clear what that's for, but it just terrifies everybody. So I thought, well, this is just very interesting. And so I began looking at the Bush family, and I started looking at W, and I said, how does a guy like him become president? And how and why did huge amounts of money from supposedly the smartest people in this country bet on this particular guy instead of, let's say, kind of a Bob Dole-ish type figure who is at least an intelligent and accomplished guy, whether you agree with him or not? Why this particular person? And the more I looked at W, the more I saw that there was some sense of him as something, part of something larger, a kind of a continuity, if you will, that he represented an ongoing mission. It wasn't so much that anybody really liked him personally. And moreover, as I looked at him, I saw that there were all these things about his past that were so problematical that if they ever came out, he never could have been elected in 2000, and he certainly never would have been reelected in 2004. One of those you know about was his military service. I mean, he just took off. He just stopped serving in the military during a war. Now, you would think a man who was president of the United States who then started a war that turned out to be under false pretenses, if you learned in the middle of that war that he himself had skipped out of another war and lied about it, that would maybe be a good story. Silly me, that maybe the media, you know, they did for like a month. For a month, to be fair, and I go into this chapter and verse in Family of Secrets, for about a month, national media tried somewhat flaccidly, but they tried to kind of look into this stuff. And the White House just ran circles around them. They were just much cleverer about it, and they stopped them. And then you had the Swift Boat Veterans for the Truth, whose website was put up by this guy who worked for Karl Rove, who later died in a plane crash, and, you know, on and on and on. I mean, a lot of effort goes into psychological operations. And you talk to anybody who's at any high level in the military, in intelligence, and frankly, in any institution, any corporation or anything, psychological operations are crucial. In other words, when you work for a big bank, you want to figure out how to convince people that the bank really cares about you. Well, we know the bank doesn't care about them at all, but yet that's what they tell them. That's psychological operations. And so psychological operations are an important part of what goes on in our country in the power process, and it's something we don't cover. We don't talk about that. The more I looked at George W., the more I saw there had been a cover-up of his military service, that a decision had been made that if this comes out, his career is ruined, and not just his career, but probably his family. And his family was now, it was the third or fourth generation that was political dynasty. And then I found the fingerprints of his father. I wondered why the father, who was already a major figure in Washington, did he not know during a war that his son had just taken off? Did he not ask him when they got together, as they often did? And so I began looking at the father, and I discovered that the father seemed like he did know, and the father seemed like he had somehow helped cover up this thing. And then I thought, well, that's very interesting, because I thought the father and the son hated each other. You remember that? That's what everybody thinks, the father and the son. And in the last few years, everybody says, gee, you know, I sure miss H.W., I sure missed the father. What a much more reasonable man he was. He went into Iraq, but he stopped. You know, he gave stuff away to the corporations, but he stopped. He did this, but he stopped. And so I thought, I'm not seeing signs of a real rift between the two of them, just a stylistic difference. And so the more I looked into it, I thought, well, I've got to look at the father. And so more than half of Family of Secrets is about George H.W. Bush, a man we knew nothing about. Nothing. He was vice president or president. In fact, if you take the two Bushes, for 20 of 28 years of this country's history, one of them was vice president or president. That has never happened before in the history of the republic. So I looked at the father, and I discovered he'd had a secret life. I wondered why they named him CIA director in 1976. At the height of investigations of the CIA, of the Kennedy assassination and other things, a guy who seemed like kind of a goofball, frankly, and that they put him in charge of this agency. Out of all the people you'd take, they said he was a neophyte. And what I discovered was he wasn't. He was CIA through and through. He had been his entire life. That's one of the revelations of Family of Secrets.
And again, that was author Russ Baker talking about his amazing book, Family of Secrets. Tune in next week to hear the conclusion of that speech. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.